Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourself.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day, Mark Kenny here from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute, coming to you from my improvised dining table studio in the lockdown capital. That's lockdown capital, as in Canberra, rather than the oft-referred to lockdown capital, which of course is Melbourne. Anyway, suffice it to say, we're all thoroughly sick of it. But remember, even that's not true, because mostly we're not sick of it, which is the whole point of lockdowns, really, to keep us safe until we can mingle again without some of us getting sick and dying, perhaps thousands a day. It's that serious, and a bunch of high-vis, low-insight, angry men doesn't change that. Indeed, losing patience when we're 8/10 of the way through is no excuse for turning Trumpist libertarian and starting to wreck the joint. Bill Shorten probably had it right when he called many of the protesters in Melbourne last week man-babies. This was a tantrum by people claiming to be disproportionately wronged. But how is their plight worse than others? On the contrary, it ignored the sacrifice of the majority and blithely dismissed the community-wide effort to work together to get past this threat. Their claims to be defending the core principles of freedom and democracy sound all very honourable, but show me the instances of these same people going to the barricades to defend freedoms for others. Think of asylum seekers, or perhaps same-sex couples, constitutional recognition for First Nations peoples, the interests of the homeless. No, this was selfishness mixed with delusion, mixed with toxic masculinity. But we should remember it was a minority, presumably the same people that would have campaigned against wartime rationing and blackout curtains. Frankly, this period has given me a deeper appreciation for the generations that lived through the war, enduring far greater deprivations and probably for far longer. Anyway, that's what I think. But what does Australia think? Someone who studies that, who tests Australian attitudes over the long term, is my colleague, Professor Matthew Gray, who is the director of the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods, and who thus heads up a series called What Australia Thinks. Matthew Gray, welcome again to Democracy Sausage.
Thank you, Mark.
Now, let's talk about this, What Australia Thinks. For those unfamiliar with it, let's start at the beginning, I guess. What is it? How is it done? And what's the value of long-term survey series such as these?
So the idea of What Australia Thinks is to make the data from social attitude surveys and public opinion polling really accessible and available to people who are not specialists, people who are working outside of universities, who are intelligent people, well-read, thoughtful, but who may not go in and actually get hold of obscure academic papers and get the data themselves and analyse it. So it tries to make the data available, and it builds upon, we've started with three long-running surveys, the Australian Election Study, which I featured on this podcast before, the ANU poll, and the World Values Survey, which has been for many years now collecting data across many countries and enabling us to compare social attitudes in Australia with other countries, and as well as over time in Australia.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. It actually brings together, in a sense, different data sets, and some of that is very specifically Australian, but some of it is also international. So that allows for, you know, rich, I guess, multi-perspective data or multifactorial data, but it also allows for those comparative analyses with international databases.
Yeah, and these surveys go back quite a number of years now. They really help us to understand something about what people in the country think, how their attitudes are changing over time, how that affects their behaviour. And it's on things that can really matter, like whether people have trust in government or confidence in democracy as an institution. It gives attitudes on things like same-sex marriage or constitutional recognition, on climate change, on income inequality. But also it can also give data that is really relevant to a point in time, like what has the impact of COVID been?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And so you mentioned some of the data being gathered over a long period of time. A survey like the Australian Election Study has been going for quite some time now, hasn't it? I think it's the oldest running continuous study of Australian elections. So that's really provides excellent sort of basis for longitudinal assessment of what is going on, what's shifting, what is changing. You match that against, for example, demographic changes, geographical distribution and a number of other things, and you can find some really interesting trends in Australian society.
And we tend to think what's happening at the moment is exceptional and very different than anything's happened in the past.
Yeah, that's the vanity of now.
And it's true that COVID is pretty unique, certainly within lifetimes of people who've lived in Australia. But there have been other periods of crisis, economic crises, you know, in many ways. One of the things that is becoming apparent is that, and I don't want to minimise the economic effects of COVID, but if you go back and look at the recession of the early 90s, arguably that's had a bigger effect on people's living standards in many ways than what's happening at the moment with COVID. So it is important to put it in perspective and then to look at, you know, what happened with the dismissal of the Whitlam government. You know, what were the levels of confidence in the idea of democracy in, you know, the mid-70s at that sort of point of crisis compared to what's been happening in Australia over the last 4 or 5 years or even with COVID?
Yeah, if we think back even more like a dozen years ago to the global financial crisis, the Great Recession as it's called in the Northern Hemisphere, it ended up being a bit of a paper crisis in Australia because of some very front-footed activity by the Rudd government at the time in terms of stimulus and the actions taken by both the government and the Reserve Bank to, you know, protect the economy and, you know, bank guarantees and the like. But for Australians at that time, and I know you're an economist, for Australians at the time, there was a lot of talk about, like at the in the media frame, there was an extraordinary amount of talk about the global financial crisis. But for many people on the ground, unlike the recession of the 1990s, as you say, there wasn't this massive spike in unemployment. Housing actually became cheaper. Interest rates went down. You know, there was cash incentives, you know, money paid as stimulus to people and the like. So it's interesting. You can make some assumptions about what people think at those moments. But the value of these surveys, it seems, is that we actually get to find out what they do think rather than, you know, a bunch of people like you and me, or particularly me as a former journalist, you know, kind of, you know, making educated guesses.
Yeah, and they talk about the echo chamber, don't they? And it's true. Right? We're influenced by the people, you know, around us, and we tend to, you know, listen to people who have similar views. And one of the real concerns about something like COVID was that it could lead to a loss of social cohesion and trust. And if that happens, you can see what happens in countries where that has happened. US would be one example of that, you know, the UK to some degree, I think. But in Australia, when we've been tracking, we find that confidence in government is pretty high, really, and it's gone up. You know, you could see it drop during the bushfire period, but it's high. It goes up and down a bit, so you know, it comes down a little bit at the moment with the third wave and concerns about vaccine rollout. But social cohesion, social trust, in fact, has gone up during the COVID period. I mean, that has been really critical. And in your introduction, you talked about how, in many ways, we've done much of the hard work in protecting Australia. You know, vaccine rates, I've lost track of exactly what they are, but I think first vaccine rates are getting quite high now, and you follow through, people are getting pretty high vaccination rates. So in order to maintain, to see the course through, because we're so close now to having vaccination rates at which the health consequences will be much reduced, it does really require that trust and confidence and social cohesion. I mean, that's why those riots and violence in Melbourne is a real challenge. But again, if you look at, if you watch the news on that, you'd say, oh, Australians are really up in arms about this. But what this long-term tracking data shows that actually Australians are pretty supportive of the measures that have been taken on the whole. And we do know that things like trust in government and social cohesion and trust in your fellow citizens and that people will act in good faith and in best interest is a strong predictor of being vaccinated. When people start to lose trust, then they will lose trust in vaccination as well.
Because they're losing trust, in a sense, in information. They're losing a trust in expertise. They're losing trust in their political leaders. And that, if you put all those things together, that's fertile ground for believing other information, false information, conspiracy theories, do your own research types on the internet.
Absolutely.
All that stuff.
And getting the Pfizer vaccine is an act of faith in a way. It's a totally new technology, developed quickly. So you have to have trust in the...
Yeah,
the vaccine developers have
had the regulators'
expertise and the regulators and the government and and when you get the vaccine stuck in your arm, that it actually is what it's supposed to be. It's not some sort of
Bill Gates conspiracy.
Bill Gates conspiracy, or a corrupt company.
yeah,
it's been paid. So I think that it is important, and we know from the evidence from previous pandemics around the world. And epidemics, that for young people who are exposed to epidemics, that they have a long-term effect on their belief in democracy and confidence in society. And that is actually one of the long-term risks of COVID and what's going on is for young people. And there is some evidence from our tracking surveys, but also from other surveys, that young people are being disproportionately affected, both economically, but in terms of mental health, schooling, and so forth. And monitoring what's going on around their views about government, about society, is really crucial. And, of course, the information can be used to help inform public policy development and the way in which things are communicated and so on, and that really does matter for the future.
Yeah, the framing of it, the design of policy, and then the framing of the communication of it is important. And it's interesting, this thing about trust, because there's a couple of dimensions to it. I want to come back to that young person aspect of it in a sec. But just staying with the broad for a moment, it is interesting, isn't it, that we saw trust kind of recover quite strongly. It spiked really through 2020 when governments were introducing measures that we thought, that were assumed to be completely beyond the pale, sort of unthinkable outside of a wartime situation. But there was a mutual recognition between the people, what I would call the represented and the representatives. They were all listening to the experts. We all became familiar with a lot of leading epidemiologists in this country, and we understood the basis of the policy, right? So we understood the notion of social distancing, of eventually of mask wearing, of hand hygiene, of essentially separating to give the stop giving the virus the bridge it needed to communicate from, to travel from one person to the next. So there was an underlying rationale, but there was also trust that governments in Australia, notoriously sort of known for bickering between the state and federal levels of government, that all of that seemed to come together to address this common threat. And we saw public confidence levels in government go up. Contrast that, and I think you touched on this before, contrast that with 2021, which has been more noted for the cracks in the Federation, the competition between the states, the failure of the vaccine procurement program to be sort of front-footed initially. And so really the story of 2021 in terms of the vaccine rollout, even though it's now starting to reach some, as you say, some critical mass, it really is the story of a very limited supply for which the federal government had, you know, had responsibility, not that it's necessarily taken it. And we've seen trust sort of pull back again. So you can really understand, you can really see the mechanics of all of this, you know, the relationship between people and their governments and the kind of factual base. You can see it all working.
You certainly can. And one of the things that comes out of the monitoring surveys we're doing is because for at least some of them, we're following the same group of people over time. And so we can look at, for example, what people said in January this year about vaccination, just as, you know, vaccines were starting to be approved, whether they thought they'd get vaccinated and what they've actually done by August. And actually, it's a very strong predictor. So if you said in January 2021, you thought it was, you know, very likely or probable that you would take get the vaccine, that's a very strong predictor of vaccine uptake. And so that sort of information, you can then look at, you know, what sort of barriers people see and so on. And certainly there is a group who are disaffected. They distrust other people. They distrust the government. And that comes through. Certainly in the early stages of the vaccine rollout, people thought it was pretty fair. You know, they understood the rationale, you know, for you start with the elderly and people with disability and underlying health conditions. What's more recent times has happened is that people are not as convinced about the fairness of the vaccine rollout. You know, there's various stories about young people from certain schools, so on, getting preferential access or, you know, people sort of saying to jump the queue. And that sense of fairness is really important in this. I mean, it's my view is that even after we're vaccinated, you know, the challenges of COVID are not going to be over, and governments are going to have to make some pretty tough decisions. The amount of money that's being spent is very high. It's not likely to be sustainable. And we've got other challenges in the world which are confronting Australia with China and amongst others. And so governments are going to be needing, I think, to make tough decisions. And probably, well, I hope they'll be making decisions which are in the long-term interest, as they've done during COVID. I mean, that is going to be one of the real challenges, is how can we get away from that sort of short-term cycle of, you know, expedient policymaking when we really are going to be facing challenges which are much more serious than, well, certainly on the economy, much more serious than we've been facing over the last decade or so.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because to do popular things doesn't necessarily dip into the sort of the trust bank, the credibility bank that governments have with people. But to do unpopular things, you need to have credibility. You need to be seen to be acting in the longer term national interest, even the medium term national interest, even though it might cause some level of short term pain. I mean, that has been essentially the secret, that, you know, the kind of heart of representative government, that it actually works well when you have leadership that is not merely populist and responsive to what people always want, but which has an overarching and particularly a temporally extended, a longer term view of what is in the national interest. And thus, action to rebalance the budget, for example, everyone knows that that's not going to make you, not going to buy you a lot of votes, but it is what we need our governments to do, to broadly speaking, to have, you know, have spending policies that are broadly commensurate with revenue policies, broadly. And don't get me wrong, I'm not some sort of, you know, Friedmanite here. I'm just making a sort of a general point about legitimacy. And it's interesting that that equation, that mechanism does require trust. It requires kind of mutual buy-in by the populace and the government. And we're seeing a fair bit of that at the moment, but it's interesting when you think about it with young people, because as you say, young people tend to have less trust in governments. I wonder whether you think, as an economist, as much as a sort of a social researcher here, whether you think that is a function of them also having less of a stake in it. It's almost like a company in which they have either no or very few shares compared to the baby boomer generation, which own lots of shares and so have a great interest in the protection of the status quo and the protection of the current distribution of property and wealth and the ongoing maintenance of the order as it is at the moment.
Yeah, one of the things we do know from surveys is that each generation is different, but each generation is also the same. So young people tend to, want to change the world. They're unhappy about certain things. But we are going through a phase now. We have structural aging of the population, which is a great sign of success. Yeah? People are living longer, and so we have an aging population. And we have young people who have been, and we've had a huge increase in wealth in Australia. I know that's been unequally distributed, which is an issue, and there's been rising income inequality, inequality in assets even more, and things like home ownership. It used to be the case that most Australians would own their own home in time, and that provided a bedrock for their life and provided them with a decent living standard in retirement. Now, that could be disrupted by things like divorce, but mental health problems or so on. But generally speaking, that was the pathway. For young people, while it's true that in many ways, I think you said the 2008 global financial crisis was kind of a paper effect in Australia, it's true in aggregate, but young people were disproportionately affected by that. And again, they're being disproportionately affected by what's going on at the moment. And so I think that there is a sense of, if society does nothing for me, why should I do something for society? There must be a social compact. And you can see it starting, the potential for it to start to play out in antisocial behaviour, in criminality. If society does nothing for you, well, people tend to think, well, I might just take it from people who do have it.
Yeah, and non-compliance would be it's almost an early sign of that, wouldn't it? Non-compliance with health orders.
It is, exactly. Yeah. And if we look at, in many ways, especially with the recovery of the stock market, which is, as of today, very strong, the wealth of many older people has gone up. Financial living standards have really improved in many ways. The mental health of people over 55 is higher than what it was in 2017. For young people, mental health is worse now than it was in 2017, and it's improved a little bit than what happened in the early stages of COVID, but it's quite negative in terms of things like financial hardship. There are broader effects of COVID in entrenching underlying fault lines and social disadvantage, but they've been particularly for young people. And the evidence that we're getting out of our polling is that young people are really starting to they had big increases in confidence in government during the early stages of COVID, but it's collapsed now, and it's sort of going back to what it was pre-COVID. And I think that is a real concern. And people are starting to see that the intergenerational compact may be begun to swing too far in favour of older generations and older people compared to younger people, because for many younger people, they would see much of the reasons for the lockdown to protect particularly older people, also people with disability or living with disability or other conditions, but particularly older generations. And they're starting to question, what does this mean for me? And especially it's starting to impact on schooling, university, apprenticeships, and so on.
Let's take a quick break and be back in a moment.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Just before the break, we were talking about the effect of young people. I wonder whether you think, and this is not inviting you to make a sort of a heroic change in government policy here, although you feel free to do so if you want to, Matthew, but I wonder whether you think the way, bearing in mind what you just said, all that very important, those important observations about young people and the fact that particularly before Delta, there was a very strong correlation between age and serious illness from COVID. Relatively few young people were becoming seriously ill and dying. It's a little bit more sort of demographically distributed, I should say, with the Delta virus, but or the Delta variant. But I wonder whether you think we got the vaccine policy right by closing young people out of it for so long, because you know there wasn't Pfizer, and we saw what happened with the AstraZeneca thing and the age restrictions that came onto it and so forth. And young people who, I think the evidence has shown since, were more keen to step forward and get a jab in the arm than any other cohort. I mean, they are pretty much the ones who feel most keenly the removal of the ability to socialize. It's so much more critical when you're young. You know, I heard someone make the point on Q&A, for example, about not just socializing, but romance, for example, young, you know, the things that are really important to people as young adults. When you get older, you might be happy to, you know, be home from work and just quietly work from home. But I just wonder sometimes whether we shouldn't have just had a, you know, first come, first served, whether we wouldn't have kind of got to at least where we are now and perhaps even higher levels of vaccination.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think time takes a different sense when you're young, you know. Mm. When you're older, you think, oh, what does another month or two matter? But you know, when you're 17 or 18, you know.
It's an eternity.
Yeah. And my daughter turns 17 tomorrow. She says, oh, she's not really having a birthday because she can't get a driver's license because, you know, driving lessons are suspended. I look at that and say, oh, well, what's the big deal? As a father, it's not a bad thing if it's another 2 or 3 months. But, you know, when you're 17, it just about turns 17, it matters. So I think that, look, I'm not an expert on the health side of vaccines, but I do think that it's pretty clear that on AstraZeneca, that was comprehensively stuffed up.
Yeah.
And young people, yeah, they would have gone and got it because, I mean, partly for their own benefit and wanting to be able to out and socialise and protect themselves, but also they do want to protect other people. You know, they don't want to make their parents or their grandparents ill. So I think that, you can see that in the data where the young people are starting to say, you know, they think they had a particularly young people thought increasingly thinking that the vaccine rollout's not been fair, not been fairly done. And if you think of the vaccine as the totemic thing, you know, this is the silver bullet. You know, once you're vaccinated, you're pretty right. I mean, I know that's not completely true, but it's pretty much true, I think. It certainly gets a very high level of protection. They're sort of missing out. And as you say, you know, younger people, older people in their own home, financially comfortable.
And look at all of the policy. Yeah, look at all of the policy that we have these battles about. You think about the last election, you know, talk about negative gearing, capital gains tax concessions, franking credits, electricity policy, the refusal to do anything on climate change because of what it might do to electricity prices or, you know, ruin your weekend or whatever that ludicrous claim was. You know, and then you look at the vaccine policy, and in both cases you've basically got the older demographic, the older section of the population, which is the most capital rich, well-resourced, looking after itself first, you know.
Yes. Yeah, and young people are. You can see it again in the data, you know, on coal, on climate change.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying every young person's got the same view, but as a group, they're pretty concerned and really worried about this and getting quite, I mean, it is a feature of the young, you know, when you're young, you tend to be more passionate and get angry.
Idealistic,
about it.
Yeah.
Idealistic and wanting a better world. And long may that continue. But, for example, social security policies have been very interesting because when they had the big increase, particularly in the job seeker payment, essentially unemployment benefit, a massively positive impact on the financial position of the poorest people in society. And that's been wound back. I mean, it's a bit higher than it was. But again, young people are disproportionately on those types of benefits. And so, again, it was a chance, I think, for government to have said, yeah, we recognise that the real value of these benefits have dropped. We recognise that you'd be disproportionately affected. They could have made a permanent increase. And there were sort of statements made about long-term financial sustainability and so on, but it doesn't seem to affect the other policies.
Yeah, exactly. And you could say, actually, you could throw into that, this might sound like a bit of special pleading bias, but you could throw into that also the lack of support for universities through this period. You know, major employers, the third or fourth largest, depending on how it's counted and when it's counted, third or fourth largest export sector of the country, left effectively on its own through this whole period. 40,000 jobs lost, universities closed, and who are the university students? Overwhelmingly, they are young people who are being denied the education and the society associated with that education.
Yeah, and
just another example of it.
And education is becoming increasingly important.
Increasingly expensive.
I'm not of the view that the only valuable education is provided through university. I think that the vocational sector is just as important, and again, it's been harder for people to get apprenticeships and so on.
Well, it's interesting that you raise that, because one of the things I noticed in the survey, and this is from the 2019 data as I understand it, but 93% of Australians think universities should train people for the needs of the economy, for employers. I wonder what your version or what your assessment of that is. I mean, to me, that sounds like the sort of data that you might, or the sort of figure that you might quote if you were arguing that universities need to be less on the ivory tower end of things and more on the kind of utilitarian vocational training side of things. Anti-humanities, anti-arts, anti-pure research.
Again, this might be a bit self-serving, but the British Academy of the Humanities did some studies on where a humanities degree leads you, doing classics, literature and history and philosophy. And they looked at the top people running major companies in the UK. People with a humanities background were disproportionately represented. Very few accountants are running major organisations. Actually, economists were underrepresented. Quite a few engineers, because, engineering business and so on. I personally think that the real value of universities is not to provide specific skills training. That's not quite true. I think medicine or pharmacy or so on, but
geology.
But I do think that the real value of the universities is about a better society, encouraging people to think and be well educated. And it's not just in the labour market. It makes people better parents, for example. And again, I'm not saying that only people with high education to be wonderful parents. That's absolutely not true. But, the higher the education level of the parents, they generally help them be good parents or volunteers or, in a whole variety of ways. So I think that I guess there's a challenge here, because you've had this massive growth of the university sector, partly international students, but also domestic, probably over time a downgrading of the vocational sector. So my view a bit is that you need to find the right balance, and it's obviously a balance that government needs to find between the funding they provide and the support they provide to universities for the vocational side versus the other side. But we do know that most people don't, in their jobs, they don't directly use what they learned at university. They go on to a whole variety of careers, particularly in social sciences, humanities, broad-based science education would be the same. People go on. So for young people, the online learning has been challenging, I think. The pressure on universities does not help the quality of their university education. I think that's true. Universities made a lot of effort to support it, but it does have an effect on the young people.
Well, especially when you've got that number of job losses. I mean, there are no doubt cases where you know, someone's tutor or lecturer is just no longer there anymore. And so they're having to sort of deal with someone else entirely, or that course is now severely compromised as a result of that. And these are real world effects. I just think it's extraordinary, even if you leave aside all the ideological frames, it's extraordinary that in a crisis like this, when so much money has been ploughed into the economy to keep, you know, through JobKeeper and so forth, to keep employees associated with employers and to try and have as much of the economy in good shape by the end of this, you know, by the time we get to the vaccination levels that we need and can start releasing all of these restrictions. And the universities have been left to wither to a large extent, and it's felt very ideologically motivated.
It's kind of ironic. I think ironic is the right word for it, that we're relying on the scientists to get us out of this pickle.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's also, of course, a fair correlation between levels of education and vaccine take-up. We were talking about vaccine take-up before. Your study shows that the 9 out of 10 Australians, or 94%, which is an extraordinarily high number, an encouragingly high number, have now either been vaccinated or intend to be vaccinated. That's pretty encouraging, isn't it?
It's extremely encouraging. And it wasn't at all certain in the early days that's what would happen. And the evidence from other countries, I mean, Australia has been, well, slow to start. I do think that we're going to end up with a pretty high vaccination rate by international standards. And again, I think that I keep going back to this, but I do think that that trust and social cohesiveness underlying it is really important. Now, the other thing that is worth saying, I think, is that, and related to this, is that there hasn't been a hardening of attitudes, for example, against migration. There's been a slightly less support for migration, but it's really held up. And again, people are not hardening against migrants who are different than the majority in Australia, you know. If we look at, for example, reports of discrimination, because that was one of the concerns, you know, with Trump going on about the China virus and it can bring out the worst in people in these situations, is that Asian Australians, community attitudes towards Asian Australians have remained remarkably positive, actually, and they haven't got more negative. And Asian Australians do experience the highest rates of discrimination, but again, that went down initially during COVID, probably because people were stuck at home and there's this opportunity to experience discrimination when you're at home. But, you know, now that things start to open up, it's not higher than what it was pre-COVID. And I think that that is a really important point.
It's an Australian success story in a way, isn't it? I mean, it's a success story about the intergenerational creeping success, if I can put it like that, of education, of a liberal education, of multiculturalism being entwined with the Australian self-identity, with values. I mean, Malcolm Turnbull used to make the point Australia is the most successful multicultural nation in the world. Now, you know, I could understand what he was saying. I think there'd be some people in racial minorities who would contest it on the basis of their experience, and they'd be very validly doing so. But I think he was sort of making it as a normative statement. He was arguing that it is true of where we've come from, and it becomes truer the more we talk about it as a positive value. And there's some statistical backup for that in these surveys.
I think so, and you can track this long term, and you can see. My assessment of the data is that it blips up and down a bit, but there is basically an upward trend. Yeah, Australians do have a sense of, if people come to Australia, they want them to sign up to the values of Australia. But there also is understanding of the diversity and a valuing of it. And again, in the COVID period, I mean, that's what the reason I think the discrimination findings are so important is that there has been quite a debate about different groups not sticking to lockdown rules and ending up with and social distancing rules and ending up with higher rates of infection, and particularly from certain countries and ethnic backgrounds. But people seem to have been able, on the whole, to understand some of the reasons for that, to do with people's experiences before they came to Australia, what that might mean about authority, about the importance of languages, and you know, if you don't speak English. Mm. Again,
how they interpret troops being on the street for knocking on their door, for example, yeah.
And also the consequences of casual employment and economic insecurity.
Yeah, the work they were doing, the work these people would do. So they're very often impossible for these people to work from home. They're doing often casual work or shift work. They're needing to move around, which has put them in more vulnerable situations and also made them more likely to be carriers.
And while you see that at the margins of society, I don't have rose-tinted glasses about this. I mean, I think that it's something we need to be continually vigilant, and the rates of discrimination and racism are too high.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
Against people in other countries and certainly against First Nations. I think Turnbull's statement, Malcolm Turnbull's statement you referred to, is a relative statement as well. I think what you're saying, really, you know, compared to other countries, it is a success story. And it does appear that COVID's not going to upset that apple cart.
One of the things that you also referred to a minute ago was, you know, like talking about multiculturalism was our attitudes. I suppose that invites the other aspect of it, the attitudes to other countries. We've seen declining trust, and I think Lowy Institute polls have shown this as well, declining levels of trust in China, in Australia. So Australia, Australians with plummeting sort of confidence that China is a net good in the world, at least the way it's behaving at the moment. The numbers also show that there is very high support for the United States. Now, that's perhaps not surprising, but it is really quite high. And I guess it underpins why there's so much safety, both literally or at least sort of defensively, as Australia would see it, but also politically for the government, bearing in mind what we've just seen unveiled in the last 2 weeks, you know, this even deeper strengthening of the defence partnership between Australia and the United States and the United Kingdom, this AUKUS agreement.
Yeah, I think that's it's very interesting. And also the Quad, you know, so, country, I mean, UK and US, I guess, are countries that we would have a lot of you would expect us, you know, certainly some of the Quad countries. I mean, it's not so. The history is different, I guess, and you can see that. I think the Lowy polls are really terrific, and they are very much focused on Australia's views about the rest of the world. And they have a really terrific website, which is also I'd encourage the listeners to have a look at. It's not as if the ANU is the only ones doing this sort of work. The Lowy is very interesting, and the Scanlon Foundation also do very interesting. There's a sort of a small group of us who are doing this kind of work. And one of the really important things which underneath, for What Australia Thinks, anybody who's interested can access the underlying raw data and do their own analysis. So if somebody thinks we haven't done it right or they've got a different question they want to answer and, you know, they've got some sort of interest in that and skills, then they can access the data through the Australian Data Archive. And that's a really important transparency thing because we're talking about trust. So one of the things is trust in data. And I believe that data should be made available to people to do their own analysis if needed. We try and make it broadly accessible through What Australia Thinks, and, you know, to school children, to university students, to the public who are just interested, to, you know, ministerial advisors, public servants, and so on. But you can actually go in and get the underlying data. If that's the thing that floats your boat, then you can get into it, and a university education could help you do that as well.
Yes, and there's it's all explained there in terms of the methodology behind how this data is gathered or data are gathered.
Yes, it's all there. So it's designed to be totally transparent in where the data comes from, what the questions were, how they were phrased, how the analysis has been done. And, you know, and if people do other analysis and say they come to a slightly different conclusion than us, then that's great. And if we've made an error somewhere along the line, you know, we'll fix it up. So that's part of this process of scientific discovery. You know, they say about being a researcher, you have to be prepared to be publicly wrong. and I think that, you know, I really believe in that. You know, if you get further information, what do you do? I mean, I change my mind.
Yeah,
I've changed my view.
No, it's very well put. the whole thing's quite a collaborative exercise, isn't it? There are other people involved and as you say, other organisations.
There are. So there are a group of academics who's really committed in this space, and there is Professor Ian McAllister, Professor Tony Mackay, who've been involved long-term in around many of the studies, Tony particularly around the world values and other surveys, Professor Nick Biddle, Dr. Jill Shepherd. So there's quite a collection of people who've made a long-term investment in this space. This isn't something that you can just dip in and out. It takes people who are prepared to really commit and to build the expertise and to have the discipline to keep going back and keep asking the questions. It's quite exciting during COVID. You know, other times there's less dramatic things going on, so it does require a real commitment and long-term investment, and that's an investment that the Australian National University has been able to make in its particular role as a national university.
Final question, does it bring to your mind, and this is sort of a question without notice, I suppose, inviting you to think about the next election, and I'm not going to ask you to predict who wins it, but does it highlight for you any of the areas where the two sides, the two major sides, obviously, will be wise to go or not go, or will need to, you know, very strongly address emergent concerns in the electorate, particularly in this post-COVID
period?
So it's
a good thing that you're not asking me to predict the election, because that's not my skill set at all. And yeah, and what I tend to,
not mine
yeah,
either.
What I tend to think important. I mean, I'm not. You know, it doesn't always what the electorate thinks, but I do think that the path out of COVID and the future society that we need, that we want to have, and that we need, is going to be really crucial. And I'd like to see that sort of vision coming out of a really serious crisis. I think we shouldn't forget the bushfires that we had and sort of receded into the past a bit, but they were really dramatic in, what's it, late 2019, early 2020. And these issues of environmental management, climate change, you know, you can see the Prime Minister's talking about it. So I think these issues of inequality within society and the type of society that we want to have post-COVID, to what extent it's made people rethink some of their priorities. And that, I hope, we'll see from our politicians, that that leadership, so that we can build a fairer and better Australia. It doesn't mean it's not been good over the last decade, but I think there's an opportunity here.
Yeah, and that fair and better point is a really good one to sort of finish on, in a sense, because I suppose what you're saying there is that these data show, we talked about this a bit before, but these data show up, you know, those relatively lower levels of trust amongst those who have less of an economic toehold. And that, of course, is mostly younger people, but not exclusively. And so distribution of wealth and opportunity is a crucial aspect of any stable, prosperous and viable polity going forward. So that also is something that governments will need to have a narrative line about.
Yes, and the balance between the balance between different groups in society will become, I think, one of the real issues on which they will need to have really serious policy consideration.
Professor Matthew Gray, thanks so much for spending time with us discussing this really quite fabulous resource, very rich data set, and for explaining how listeners can also get into that themselves. So thanks for coming on Democracy Sausage once again.
You're welcome, Matt. Thank you.
And thank you. That's it for Democracy Sausage this week. I might just also finish by thanking Angus Blackman, executive producer of this barbecue-based GabFest, and, of course, to the Crawford School of Public Policy for its fantastic administrative support. That's it for now. See you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.